the podcast from Belmont Chapel in Exeter, sharing the story, living the life. For more information, go to belmontchapel.org.uk.
Well, good evening. We're going to look at Mark chapter 7 tonight, and it's a chapter in which there are three separate stories. Let's have a look at it now and read those three together. Mark chapter 7, in case you haven't yet found it, is on page 954 of the Green Bible, and we'll read from verse 1. So, first incident, verse 1. The Pharisees and some of the teachers of the law who'd come from Jerusalem gathered round Jesus and saw some of his disciples eating food with hands that were defiled, that is, unwashed. The Pharisees and all the Jews do not eat unless they give their hands a ceremonial washing, holding to the tradition of the elders. When they come from the marketplace, they do not eat unless they wash. And they observe many other traditions, such as the washing of cups, pitchers, and kettles. So, the Pharisees and teachers of the law asked Jesus, "Why don't your disciples live according to the tradition of the elders, instead of eating the food with defiled hands?" He replied, "Isaiah was right when he prophesied about you hypocrites. As it is written, these people honor me with their lips, but their hearts are far from me. They worship me in vain. Their teachings are merely human rules. You've let go of the commands of God and are holding on to human traditions." And he continued, "You have a fine way of setting aside the commands of God in order to observe your own traditions. For Moses said, 'Honor your father and mother,' and 'Anyone who curses their father or mother is to be put to death.' But you say that if anyone declares that what might have been used to help their father and mother is korban, that is, devoted to God, then you no longer let them do anything for their father or mother. Thus you nullify the word of God by a tradition that you have handed down. You do many things like that." Again, Jesus called the crowd to him and said, "Listen to me, everyone, and understand this. Nothing outside you can defile you by going into you. Rather, it is what comes out of you that defiles you." After he'd left the crowd and entered the house, his disciples asked him about his parable. "Are you so dull?" he asked. "Don't you see that nothing that enters you from the outside can defile you? For it doesn't go into your heart, but into your stomach and then out of your body." In saying this, Jesus declared all foods clean. He went on, "What comes out of you is what defiles you. For from within, out of your hearts, come evil thoughts, sexual immorality, theft, murder, adultery, greed, malice, deceit, lewdness, envy, slander, arrogance, and folly. All these evils come from inside and defile you." Second story. Jesus left that place and went to the vicinity of Tyre. He entered a house and didn't want anyone to know it, yet he could not keep his presence secret. In fact, as soon as she heard about him, a woman whose little daughter was possessed by an evil spirit came and fell at his feet. The woman was a Greek, born in Syrian Phoenicia. She begged Jesus to drive the demon out of her daughter. "First let the children eat all they want," he told her. "For it's not right to take the children's bread and toss it to the dogs." "Lord," she replied, "even the dogs under the table eat the children's crumbs." Then he told her, "For such a reply, you may go. The demon has left your daughter." She went home and found her child lying on the bed, and the demon gone. Third story. Then Jesus left the vicinity of Tyre and went through Sidon, down to the Sea of Galilee and into the region of the Decapolis. There some people brought to him a man who was deaf and could hardly talk, and they begged Jesus to place his hand on him. After he took him aside, away from the crowd, Jesus put his fingers into the man's ears. Then he spat and touched the man's tongue. He looked up to heaven, and with a deep sigh said to him, "Ephphatha," which means "be opened." At this the man's ears were opened, his tongue was loosed, and he began to speak plainly. Jesus commanded them not to tell anyone, but the more he did so, the more they kept talking about it. People were overwhelmed with amazement. "He's done everything well," they said. "He even makes the deaf hear and the mute speak." So that's our passage for tonight. Here's a picture that's become pretty famous over the last week or so. Charles Saatchi, in an interesting position, having lunch with his wife. And this one, is, I suppose, is even more worrying. Charles sat with his hands round his wife's neck. He said he was emphasising a point strongly. I must try that out on Anthea sometime, see how it works. I think I get bitten, however. Anyway, it's caused a sensation, hasn't it? Because we thought we knew Charles Saatchi and Nigella Lawson. And in fact, we don't. There's a lot about their relationship we're not too sure about. And from the fact that she has since appeared in public several times, not wearing her wedding ring, we suspect there's something going on in that relationship which runs deeper and is more violent than anything we'd assumed up until now. And it's funny how somebody can be in the public eye and we get the wrong impression of them. I well remember back in 1974, told you how old I am, being fairly staggered when this guy went missing and then was found in Australia. He was John Stonehouse, a Labour minister who had held several government posts, and in fact I think at the time he went was Postmaster General. We thought he'd gone missing, tragically drowned on a beach in the Bahamas. In fact, he'd faked his own disappearance to get away from his debts and other embarrassments he was facing, and he surfaced in Australia. He was taken back to Britain and given a prison sentence. And I remember being slightly shaken by that, because at that point, not many politicians ended up in that way. People who were pillars of the establishment, government ministers, just didn't behave like that. And the whole idea that you could be so prominent and in such a respected position and yet have such a strange second life going on was quite something. Yet we've become quite used to it, sadly, over the last few years, haven't we? And just over this last week, we've seen all sorts of people in public life who have been shown to be something different from what they actually are. Take Michael Applebaum, for instance, who, as the mayor of Montreal in Canada, came in last year on a ticket to clear up corruption in the city. He's just been sacked for corruption himself. Or take the mayor of Toronto, just down the road, Rob Ford, who was photographed seemingly smoking crack cocaine just two or three weeks ago, and who also, as a result, has lost his job. Or closer to home, take Petr Nikas, premier of Czechoslovakia, or the Czech Republic, I should say, who has lost his job and brought his government crashing down because of the corrupt activities of the girl that he's been having an affair with for the last few years. People who look powerful, who look prominent, who look to have everything going for them on one level, and yet had something very strange happening inside their lives. And I guess Jesus, at this stage in the Gospel of Mark, has become so prominent, so powerful, so well known, that it's time he was checked out. And that's why in verse 1 you have some Pharisees coming up from Jerusalem to check him out. I suppose Jesus has become more prominent because of a couple of things that happened in chapter 6, if you just flick back to what we were talking about last week. For one thing, John the Baptist is now dead. Now, he had been the Pharisees' great enemy in many ways. When they came to him for baptism, he'd said, "You're a brood of vipers. Who's warned you to flee from the wrath to come?" Which is not the way to make friends and influence people. So the Pharisees didn't have a lot of time for John the Baptist. He had now disappeared. So the next enemy on the list was Jesus. What's more, you find in chapter 6 that Jesus is not just going around himself healing and teaching and telling stories. He sends out the 12. And so he's multiplied his work by 12. And there are people all over the place now representing him, talking about his message, spreading it throughout the country. It's high time the people in the south checked out what is behind the public face of Jesus Christ. Of course, it wasn't the first time they'd come to see him. Back in chapter 3, in verse 22, you find some people coming up the road from Jerusalem. But at that point, they just tried to dismiss him and say, "Oh, he's demon-possessed. He's mad. He's off his head. Don't listen to him." Well, people had listened to him. And he kept on building up his reputation. And now, four chapters later, they really, really, really need to check him out. And so that's the first thing that happens here. They come out to see what Jesus is all about. Now, who are these Pharisees? If you look at Jews in the world today, you find that Jewish people fall into several different categories. And if you arrange them along a spectrum, from the Orthodox Jews at one end, who hold to the traditions and practices that have gone on for hundreds of years, you've got a whole spectrum of Jews. Somewhere in the middle, you've got the Reformed Jews, and further along, you've got the liberal Jews, gradually losing the respect for tradition as you move along the line, until you get to the end of the line, the Reconstructionist Jews, They're a group that started in 1920 with this guy, Mordecai Kaplan, who was a rabbi who just didn't believe in God. But he believes Judaism is still important because it's a folk tradition and the folk ways of Judaism must be preserved to keep that people together. And so you have the whole spectrum there from people who, on the one hand, believe that being right with God is a matter of keeping lots of traditions, to people at the other end who don't believe in God at all. And outside, off the scale, I guess, you've got groups like Kabbalah, the odd group that people like Madonna belong to, which is hardly Jewish at all, although it takes its derivation from the Jewish scriptures and has its own peculiar kind of belief based on Judaism. You've also got the political movements like Zionism, and you can be a Zionist and a member of any of those groups or none. And so the whole picture is very confusing. Now, the reason I'm saying this is because it was just like that in Jesus' day too. You had the same spectrum. You had the people who were the military figures out like the Zionists, the Zealots who wanted to see the country unified, who wanted to see the purity of the nation reestablished. You had the people who were out off the scale, like the Essenes down in the desert by the Dead Sea, the place that the Dead Sea Scrolls came from, who believed that only they were really going to survive the end of the world, and the end of the world was coming pretty quick. On the scale, amongst Orthodox Jews, you had most Jews, I suppose, somewhere in the middle, not at one of the extreme ends. But you did have two extreme ends as well. You had at one end the Sadducees, a bit like the Restorationists, Reconstructionists rather, nowadays. People who had very small belief in their traditions or in the scriptures. They were the ones that worked with the Romans. They were the ones who had political power in Jesus' day. All of the chief priests and the people who were power fixers in Jerusalem came from the Sadducees at that end. But at the other end, you had the Pharisees. And the Pharisees were the ones who were like the Orthodox nowadays, I guess. They were the ones that held on to the traditions. They believed that Israel had been taken into captivity hundreds of years before because they hadn't kept the law. And so they'd added to the law all kinds of extra ones to make it that bit more difficult to keep, because they believed only that in hedging around the law could you have a real assurance that God was going to be pleased with you. And it was that bunch, out of all the Jews that could have come, that had come to check out Jesus. And so they came up to Galilee and watched what Jesus was doing. And perhaps they had an agenda right from the word go, because they were trying to find fault. They were trying to find something they could condemn him for. And it didn't take them all that long. They found very, very quickly that Jesus' disciples were not washing their hands in the same way that they thought they should. Now, let me make this clear. It wasn't that they weren't washing their hands at all. That's not the situation. They weren't washing their hands in a certain ritual way. Now, it was a ritual way that was prescribed for the priests in the Old Testament when they went into the tabernacle. But the Pharisees had expanded this out and said, for any meal, wherever you are, if you're a proper Jew, you will do this thing. And the people said, yeah, but it only applies to the priests. It doesn't. It applies to all of us, not if you want to be a real proper Jew. And so they were scandalized to find that the disciples were having their meals without going through this ritual washing process. They're a bit like the Orthodox nowadays, as I say. People who belong to tradition so strongly that just nothing changes. It's interesting, if you look at pictures of Orthodox Jews today and back in, say, 1915, which is where this picture's taken, nothing much has changed. It's the traditions. It's the rules. It's the folkways. They are the important thing. You've got to hang on to those, whatever else happens. And as they came and started to investigate Jesus, I think Mark shows you through this chapter that Jesus has a message that they're not ready for. A message which goes, first of all, and this is where we're going in the next 15 minutes, beyond religious practices. Second, that goes beyond racial pride. And third, that goes even beyond realistic possibility. And I think our three stories are coupled together in this passage to make those three points. So let me just have a look at those with you. Beyond religious practices. They were scandalized that the hand washing wasn't going on. There were rules about hand washing. If you were going to do this ceremonial hand washing, you had to have enough water to start with. It had to be special water, and you had to have at least an eggshell and a half full of it. Anything less wasn't enough. You started washing from your fingertips down to your wrist. When you'd reached your wrist, you took your fist and cleaned one palm like that and the other palm like that, and then you cleaned up from your wrist to the top of your fingers again. And only when you had done that were you ready to have your meal or eat your bread or whatever it was you were doing. And you had to do it in that way. As I say, it's not there in the Bible. It wasn't imposed on the Jews, but they had made it that way through tradition. G. Campbell Morgan, the preacher that you see here in the picture says this: there had grown up a great body of traditions, traditions which in the first place were intended to be interpretations of the law and applications of the law to local circumstances, traditions which in the second place became interpretations of traditions and applications of traditions, and the traditions in the third place which were interpretations of interpretations of interpretations of traditions. And so the whole business had just become overgrown and overladen with all sorts of rules that just had to be kept. In fact, one of the rabbis said this: "He sinneth as much who eateth with unwashen hands as he that lieth with an harlot." And you can see how the whole moral system is becoming overbalanced in a silly direction. How can it possibly be as bad not to wash your hands as to sleep with a prostitute? Yep, that's what they were saying. It's that bad. The rules matter that much. And Jesus said, this is not the case. You've changed it. And by doing it, you've taken the humanity out of the law. And he says, as we read, I'll give you one example. This Korban thing. Now, what was all that about? Well, it was about the fact that the law of the Old Testament says you must honour your father and mother. And for the Jews, that meant you must take care of your father and mother. There's no social security system. There's no old age pension. Your only hope, if you get old, is that your kids are going to be good to you and look after you. And some of them were saying, well, you know, the money I've got that I could use for my mum and dad, I'm going to give it to the temple. And there was a way of handing it over to the temple and saying, I'm giving this money to God. Which meant that if you did that, you didn't have to look after mum and dad any longer. Now, there are several advantages in that. For one thing, by taking that sum of money and handing it over, you knew how much you were giving. Whereas when you start looking after elderly people, as some of you out there know, it becomes a bottomless pit if you're not careful. Their needs can go way beyond what you're expecting. And once you've started being committed to them, you just have to keep on going. So they dealt with the whole situation in one. They'd also got a lot of credit for themselves. I have given all my money to God. So it's a shame about mum, but aren't I spiritual, really? It was kind of like that. And of course, another advantage was, and this was the real one, you didn't actually have to give it to the temple. It stayed there in your bank account as a hedge against bankruptcy. You couldn't spend it on yourself, but nor did you have to hand it over. You just said, this is God's money, and one of these days I will give it to him. Just God never got it, and it stayed there in your bank account, and your mum and dad went without. And Jesus said, that's crazy. You can do that within the rules of your tradition, and what it means is you're actually denying, you're walking away from one of the things that God has actually explicitly commanded you to do. And so when we do that, when we start relying on tradition, on the outside, on putting on a good front, on keeping the little things, the small things, while there's something wrong inside us, as Nick was saying this morning, we get a million miles away from what God really wants from people. I suppose there are three dangers involved in living in a legalistic kind of faith like this. First of all, there's a danger that will condemn our acquaintances, that we'll look at other people and we'll judge them in the way that these petty traditions tend to assess them. I grew up in the kind of church where there were all sorts of rules that were made about the way that people ought to live. You know, you could not attend football matches. You could not wear lipstick, especially if you're a boy. You could not do all kinds of different stuff. And you certainly couldn't smoke or anything like that. And I remember as a small child becoming very aware there was a difference between the saved people and the unsaved people. And sometimes on a bus or a train journey, I'd be looking at the people around me and thinking, I wonder if they're saved. No, he's just lit up a cigarette. He's unsaved. Oh, she's got earrings. She's definitely unsaved. And that was the way we were trained to think. And it's crazy, isn't it, that outside signs like that become a mark of inner spirituality. And if we are not careful, we'll judge one another like that. There's a second danger, though, as well, which is that we'll look at ourselves and we'll rationalize our behavior. Well, I may not look after my father and mother, but I have given all my money to God. Well, I may not do such and such, and I have slept with prostitutes, but I have washed my hands before every meal in the last 20 years. And we build ourselves up on the little things, the things that don't really count as far as God is concerned, the things that impress other people but don't impress the God who looks on our hearts. And we rationalize big wrongs inside us by focusing on the little things that we get right. And of course, the third danger then starts on that, isn't it? which is that we start ignoring our situation. Looking at our record and thinking, well, I do this and I do that and I do the other thing, instead of looking at the raging need and the tremendous anarchy and lawlessness that there is inside us. And we build our stability and our identity and our confidence on the little things we do right, instead of the heart that's a million miles away from any form of loyalty to God. That was the first thing that Jesus was warning about. And I think he was saying we need to see first and foremost, before he can do anything for us, one thing very clearly. We need to see the wrong in us. Until I realize, until you realize, there is something wrong inside us that can't be sorted out by self-discipline, can't be sorted out by keeping certain practices, can't be sorted out by sheer willpower, but which relies on God to work a miracle in us to make it any different. Until we see that, and how desperately needy we are, Jesus Christ cannot help us. That, it seems to me, is the first thing this passage is saying. But then there's a second thing. Jesus' message not only went beyond religious practices to a revolution of the inside, it went also beyond racial pride. After he'd said these things to the Pharisees, Jesus very prudently went north. He left Galilee and he went up to the region of Tyre, where he met the Syrophoenician woman. How does all that fit together? Well, okay, let's have a look at the map. The red blob is Jerusalem down in the south, where the Pharisees had come from. The yellow area up in the north is Galilee, which is where they'd come to see Jesus. And then Jesus went off a bit north, up to the seacoast, and that's Syrophoenicia up there, the borders of Israel and Syria nowadays. And in Jesus' day, this was an area that was pretty much in rivalry with Galilee, where he came from. In fact, Josephus, the Jewish historian who lived around about the same time as Jesus, wrote later, after Jesus had died, that the greatest enemy the Israelites had were the people of Tyre. Why? Because they were economic rivals. They were on the seacoast. They had better trading links than the Galileans. They had the same kinds of industries, the same kinds of pursuits, and as a result, they were competing in the same economic market, and they did pretty well. And so this woman who comes to Jesus is somebody who represents a bunch of people who are not Israelites, who are keeping the Israelites poor, who are profiting at their expense. As one Bible commentator put it, it's as if, you know, Mother Teresa, there in her orphanage amongst the untouchables, is visited by a Brahmin priest from the most upper class caste in India, who insists that she leaves the untouchables alone and comes to look after his sick child. That's the kind of demand that's being made here. And Jesus answers in what seems a pretty unfeeling way, doesn't he? He doesn't respond to the woman. He simply says, let the children eat all they want. It is not right to take the children's bread and toss it to the dogs. What's he saying? He's saying, I've been sent to the Israelites. It's not my job to preach to the rest of the world. You're not an Israelite. One of these days the gospel will go to everybody. It's not time for that yet. I've told my disciples when they go out just to go to the house of Israel, not to go beyond the boundaries. So you've got no right. You're not one of the children. You are, in fact, one of the dogs. And he used that word deliberately because that was the way that Israelites spoke about Gentiles. You see, dogs were not cuddly pet dogs in general in Israel. They were pretty horrible curs that you kept outside the house. I remember on my one trip to Pakistan a few years ago, walking across a park to get to a river with an old missionary. And as we walked down the path, he just stopped and froze in absolute fear. And I said, what's the matter? He said, don't move a muscle. And there was this scrawny looking dog on the road in front of us. I thought, what's going on here? But he didn't want me to move, so I stood still, and eventually the dog wandered off. He said, whew, now we can go. I said, that was just a dog. He said, just a dog. Dogs round here have rabies. Dogs round here are not pets. They'll attack you as soon as look at you. Dogs round here are dangerous. So I thought, oh, I wish you'd told me that last night before I went out for a walk on my own. But anyhow, that was the way it was, and that was the way it was in Israel. Dogs were not much liked. The Gentiles saw things differently. The Romans and the Greeks kept dogs inside their houses, which to the Jews was so dirty and disgusting, it was unbelievable. And so they called the owners dogs, as well as the animals. And so Jesus is simply ironically saying to the woman, look, this is what I'm supposed to think of you, isn't it? He softens it, admittedly, and if you study the Greek, you'll see that the word he uses for dogs wasn't a normal one that Jews used. It was a word that was used for pet dogs, for house dogs, not for the real mangy curs that wandered about the place. But even so, it was a pretty harsh thing to say. And I think what Jesus is doing here is simply challenging this woman. How much do you believe in me? How much faith do you have that I will answer your prayers? Do you really believe I'm interested in you, or do you not? And she looks him straight in the eye and says, I might be a dog, but even a dog gets to go under the table and eat the crumbs that fall from it, doesn't it? And Jesus is thrilled by this, because she's saying, look, I have no rights. I have no claim on you. I'm not coming to you because of the wealth of my nation or the power of my position or anything like that. I'm coming to you as someone who's in total need and has no right to have anything from you. All I'm looking for is a crumb from the table. And Jesus says, go home. Your daughter's healed. And I think what this story is saying to us is that we've got to avoid two different ways of thinking about the grace of God. One wrong way to think about the grace of God is the Jewish way of thinking, I have more right to the grace of God than anybody else. Jesus wasn't really saying, you're a dog, they're the children, I'm here for the children, go away. He wasn't saying that at all. What he was saying is, this is the message that you've heard from the Jews, right? This is what you've heard so far. You believe I've got a different message, is that so? And she pinned all of her faith on that. She counted on the fact that Jesus really did have a radical message that counted her in as well as everybody else. And it's easy for us to think that we belong more than other people just because we've been around longer, perhaps because we've been brought up in the church. We know the Bible better than other people. We have a special deal with God. It's not that way. We have no more right to the grace of God than anybody else. And the second mistake you can make, I guess, would have been the mistake that the Syrophoenician woman could have made. That I have no right to the grace of God at all. And there are plenty of people who think, I'm not like those Christians. I don't belong in those circles. I'm not in that social class. I don't have the confidence. I don't have the nice families that they all seem to have. And there are many, many people on the fringes of our church here who are daunted by the perfect, perfect lifestyles we seem to have. Maybe we're just better at concealing the mess than other people are. But it's easy for people to feel, I don't belong. God likes them, but he can't like me. And Jesus here is saying through this encounter, this Syrophoenician woman, get a handle, not just on the need inside, but also on the goodness of God. We need to see the wrong in us, but there's another thing we need to see as well. And what we need to see is the goodness in God. The goodness that's undiscriminating. The love that will not let you go. The grace that imposes no conditions. That doesn't discriminate between this person and that person, between this race and that race, but reaches out to everybody and wants everybody to come back home. Once you've focused on the need inside you, then the goodness in God is the next thing you've got to get straight. Well, Mark has almost given us the whole of Jesus' message, but there's one more important thing to come. And so he picks on one miracle and gives us this miracle to finish off the chapter. Interesting that he does this, because in Matthew, who tells the same story and obviously draws for his story on what Mark has already written, in Matthew you find that Jesus actually did lots of miracles at this point. So why does Mark focus in on just this one? The man who is deaf and dumb, who cannot speak, who's brought to Jesus, and who then becomes able to speak. Well, I think it's for a very good reason. It's because Mark wants to show that Jesus' message only works because it goes beyond realistic possibility. The reason he can deal with the need in us, the reason he can bring the staggering goodness of God into our situation, is because Jesus has a power that no one else does. It's an interesting miracle, isn't it? Why does Jesus put his fingers into the guy's ears? Why does he spit and touch the man's tongue? What's going on here? Well, I guess it's partly because this fellow can't communicate, and he can't receive communications. But he can feel what Jesus is doing. And Jesus wants to reach across the divide and make it clear to this man what exactly is happening to him. He's met with Jesus, and Jesus is going to change him. And so Jesus performs this miracle in a particular way that involves the guy. and makes him part of what's going on. Jesus reaches beyond the barrier of silence that has shut him in since years and years and years, and reaches right through to the heart of the man's need. And his ears are opened, his tongue is loosed, he begins to speak plainly. What's the point of this miracle? Well, it's one word that's used. You see, when Mark describes the condition of this guy, he uses a very unusual word, mogilalon, which means he finds it difficult to speak. Well, it means more than difficult to speak. It means an impediment. It means that when he spoke, nobody could understand him. But comes from two words, mogis, which means with difficulty, and lalon, which means speaking. So speaking with great difficulty. The only time that this rather peculiar Greek word is used in the New Testament. Why is it significant? Because if you go back to the Old Testament, and the Greek version of the Old Testament, which Jesus and his disciples and everybody at that time used, you will find the word mogilalos used only once in the Old Testament. And so clearly the word is used here to tie together this passage from Mark chapter 7 and what Jesus is doing at this point with the prophecy that it comes from in the Old Testament. What is that prophecy? Well, it's Isaiah chapter 35. Let me just read you a few words from there. This is what Isaiah said. The desert and the parched land will be glad. The wilderness will rejoice and blossom. Like the crocus, it will burst into bloom. It will rejoice greatly and shout for joy. The glory of Lebanon will be given to it, the splendor of Carmel and Sharon. They will see the glory of the Lord, the splendor of our God. Strengthen the feeble hands. Steady the knees that give way. Say to those with fearful hearts, be strong, do not fear. Your God will come. He will come with vengeance, with divine retribution. He will come to save you. Then, says Isaiah, looking forward to what Jesus is going to be doing 700 years later, then will the eyes of the blind be opened and the ears of the deaf unstopped. Then will the lame leap like a deer and the mogilalos shout for joy. Water will gush forth in the wilderness, streams in the desert. The burning sand will become a pool, the thirsty ground bubbling springs. In the haunts where jackals once lay, grass and reeds and papyrus will grow. The redeemed of the Lord, he says, will return. They'll enter Zion with singing. Everlasting joy will crown their heads. So what's Mark saying by reminding his readers about Isaiah chapter 35? Clearly he's saying, this is what's happening. You get beyond religious practices and you see the need inside you. Yet get beyond racial pride and you see that God loves everybody regardless of discrimination. And you get beyond realistic possibility. And when you see the wrong in you and the goodness in God, you also see the power in Jesus Christ. And only this person, out of all human history, can bring together your wrong and God's love and divine power and change the entire situation. Who do you say that I am? These three stories aren't coupled together by some kind of accident. They're there to make us think. How much am I relying on what I've got? How much am I relying on external things? And how much am I relying on the power of Jesus to communicate the goodness of God to deal with the need in me?